The sun has gone down at Hangman's Hill, and the ghost at Misery Corner isn't walking tonight. So, welcome to the Weird Tales Radio Show, your weekly fix of ghost stories, urban myths, witchcraft, magic, and folklore. And now, here's your host, writer, award-winning journalist, best-selling author, and sometime werewolf hunter, Charles Christian.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Weird Tales Radio Show with me, Charles Christian. And it's yet another big interview this week, so big I've left myself almost no time to say anything other than hello and goodbye. This time our guest is Jonathan Ferguson, the Keeper of Firearms and Artillery at the UK's National Firearms Centre, which is part of the Royal Armouries Museum in Leeds. And he is taking us on a whistle-stop tour of very dangerous toys for boys. Not only discussing the 27,000-plus pistols, rifles and machine guns in the museum's collection, but also discussing how they are depicted accurately or otherwise in movies, TV series and computer gaming. Jonathan, who is also the associate editor of Armax, the Journal of Contemporary Arms, began his career as an archaeology student before moving over to the museum sector, going to the Royal Armouries in 2009. His research interests include the use and effect of firearms, both historic and contemporary, their popular perception, mythology, and their depiction in mass media. And he's appeared on numerous TV documentaries, including the History Channel's Sean Bean's Waterloo. More recently, he began making a series of YouTube shorts on the Royal Armouries channel, covering all aspects of firearms, including some of history's curios, one-offs and knock-offs. It's my great pleasure to be talking to Jonathan Ferguson, who is the Keeper of Firearms and Artillery at the Royal Armouries. Now, I've been to the Royal Armouries, though a long time ago. For people who aren't aware of it, tell us what your job entails.
I get this quite a lot, actually. what do you do all day? Not least from my wife, who thinks I play with guns all day. Myself and my small team are responsible for the sort of knowledge side of things as it pertains to guns, large and small. So we have a curator of artillery down at Fort Nelson who deals with the big guns. Mm-hmm. And I have a small team up at Leeds, and we do everything else, basically, including small arms ammunition. So in terms of what that entails on a day-to-day basis, it's research, writing, public inquiries, exhibition work, online stuff, and important housekeeping things like cataloging, documentation, the sort of, you know, measurements and photographs, and then the research feeds into that as well. So it's our job to know as much as possible about everything that we have as far as we can. And I've also been doing quite a bit online on YouTube and the like lately as well, just to sort of try and get us and the collection out there, especially while we've been shut, but we are open again, thankfully.
Looking at your bio, I saw that you originally studied as an archaeologist. Now, I appreciate archaeologists do a lot more than digging in holes, pulling up bits of dead Romans and things, but how did you get into the firearms thing? It seems a bit of a jump. I mean, I must admit, when I first saw your videos, I assumed that perhaps, without doing any research, I assumed perhaps you were ex-military or something of that nature.
Yeah, that's a common assumption as well. And in fact, some of my colleagues outside my curatorial team are ex-military because of some of the work that we do, being a sort of an arm's length government body, if you like. But on the museum side, our backgrounds vary. So the sort of discipline, the field, is arms and armour. And firearms are a subset of that, as is artillery. And there is no sort of one-stop shop to go and study that. There was for a time at the University of Hull. There was an arms and armour undergraduate course set up with our help. And that's sadly no more. But one of my curators graduated from that course. Aside from that, we have a variety of backgrounds. We have a couple of art historians, a couple of archaeologists like me, military historians sort of gravitate this way, unsurprisingly. And then sort of people who've done, I won't say generic history degrees, but less specific history qualifications. So a range of backgrounds. And my way in was archaeology. And I was thinking of being a field archaeologist, but I must admit that a roof over my head and not getting covered in mud all the time appealed. And so I thought, it's really the stuff that comes out of the ground that I'm particularly interested in. So I went for a museum career. And long story short, gravitated toward, I suppose, industrial collections in the first instance. Or at least those are the posts that were available. And I was certainly interested in the subject matter there. Then to military history, and then ever downwards, if you like, more granular level, down to firearms. And I've been doing that for about a decade.
Yeah. Now, one of the things that is intriguing, and I've seen comments on your YouTube channel, and we'll obviously give the links to it in the metadata and at the end of the show, is that, as you know, the commentators say, you seem to have the dream job of playing with exotic firearms all day. Is that the case? I mean, you seem to have this huge... How many firearms, we're talking pistols and rifles and machine guns and things, how many firearms does the armourers have?
It's the last detailed count that I did, because we have them in different cataloging categories, and it's not as straightforward as you'd think to just check the latest total.
Yeah.
The last total I got several years ago was 26,003, which stuck in my head for some reason. But it's rather more than that. It's more like 27,000, I think, all told.
Yeah.
Because we have things like handling collections, as other museums do as well, and things out on loan. And as to the dream job, absolutely. I don't take it for granted for a moment. I'm very fortunate to be not only in a field that I'm very interested in and would be glad to be working in if I was looking after teapots or coins or whatever, I'd still be happy. But I'm extra happy because it's one of the areas that I have always been interested in. So it's the classic sort of boy stuff of trains, planes, automobiles, dangerous animals.
Yep.
Guns, swords, you know, all that stuff. Always been my strongest interests, and this is one of the top. You know, if you came to 12-year-old me and said, "What would you like to be doing?" I wouldn't even have thought of this at that point, but I'm you know, he'd be very pleased. I've never grown up to that extent. However, you know, the first world problems, if you like, are that there's never enough time in the day for the interesting part of the job. So I have to sit by sometimes and out of the corner of my eye watch researchers come in and do all the interesting stuff while I do a lot of admin and collections management work, which is important, but you know, definitely not playing with guns. But I certainly get the opportunity and I make the opportunity to do so wherever I can. So in the last five or so years, I've published more than I did in the first five, as I became more aware that. And to be fair, my institution, Royal Armouries, has been very supportive of us all doing research and publishing. And that's the way to really get meaningful playing with things, if you like. Not playing, scholarly analysis and study. Yes.
Yeah.
That's the great thing. Because it's one thing to look at something and not really know what you're looking at. It's quite another to really dive into it, assess it on its own terms as a 3D object, and go away and look at the published literature. We have an archive that came with a lot of the more modern, by which I mean 1850s onwards, material here. And so you can really build quite an amazing picture of a given object or type of object. And of course, the gold-plated result is if you also have a known human connection as well. So you know who owned it, possibly what they did with it. All of that comes together to make the sort of the perfect, whether it's a display or an article.
Where do these guns come from? I mean, obviously the military ones are almost, if you like, army surplus and are available from, you know, if you like, legitimate channels. But where do some of the more obscure ones come from? I mean, you had your most recent one was of an English version of an Italian bicycle machine gun from World War One.
Yeah, this excellent question. Yeah, so in that, that's a good example because that was collected by a sort of predecessor organization, the Ministry of Defense Pattern Room, which people may or may have heard of or may have read of if they're into this stuff. Mm-hmm. And that was a really one of three, but it was the biggest and best MOD reference collections. And they would get stuff from all over the place. And they had the means to do, you know, literally go and get it from sandy places or wherever it might have been found during a conflict or something or after it. And also to sort of exchange if necessary, which we, as a modern museum, we can no longer do. So, but they could swap, say, I don't know, a generic Sten gun or pile of them to a given organization or individual, legitimate collector or otherwise, and get something super unique and important. And I don't actually know without checking how the Pattern Room ended up with that machine gun you're talking about. But it was, it was a trials weapon. So that actually, that wasn't sort of acquired from outside to the MOD and then acquired by us as a big job lot, if you like, which is what happened with that collection, which doubled our holdings of firearms overnight, by the way, in 2005, when we acquired that Pattern Room collection. But in that specific case, being ex-trials, it would have been in the system, in the MOD system, and the Pattern Room was a known entity, and the custodian there actively went around looking for things, knew, had all the contacts, and it, someone would have gone, oh, do you want this? And he'd said yes. Or he'd have seen it somewhere and gone, I'm having that. And by hook or by crook, he'd have got hold of it. Sometimes we don't quite know what the ultimate, you know, source of something was, but with that kind of material, it's either ex-trials or it's, you know, legally acquired war booty, if you like, from a from a conflict zone. Mm-hmm. Things are donated. You know, we still get people finding things in their attic. Often that stuff is, we're a bit too, as the expression is, well served. when I put in the email, I'm very sorry, but we are well served for Webley Mark VI revolvers or Lugers. But having said that, in my time, we've acquired several like that because they came with such great history. Right. You know, one of the Lugers came with a portrait photo of the guy that captured it and used it to shoot a German officer that was trying to kill him. Other items, there's actually a silver cigarette case with a bullet hole through it, which the donor is hanging on to for the time being, but has promised us in future, and various documents relating to his service. So you can build a bit more of a history. But they really do come from all over the place. The police are a major source for us today because we're no longer, you know, the collection is no longer MOD and it's no longer an arm of government per se. We are sort of, you know, an arm's length body, if you like. So we can't just dial into the system and order up a new SA-80 or something. We have to go through the, you know, external contacts. It's a big part of the job. Even if we don't have a huge budget to go out and buy stuff, to actually try and get the stuff, you know, and a lot of the police are very busy. They don't necessarily know about us. And when they do know about us, we often say no, because again, it can be quite generic material, but then you find a gem, you know, that you would have missed otherwise.
And I think it's worth pointing out for non-UK listeners, particularly American listeners, that we have very, very strict firearms laws in the UK. And it's pretty much impossible for an ordinary citizen to legally own or acquire a firearm. I think that probably sums it up without going into
Not strictly true.
Oh, right.
That's the impression that a lot of people have, both externally and in the UK, but there are various provisions under which you can own a firearm in the UK, but it's safe to say that it is, by American standards, strictly regulated. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right.
And things like handguns, self-loading rifles, automatic weapons are essentially, for most people, for most intents and purposes, impossible to get.
Yes. And the guns you have, Are they still in working order, or have they been de-armed, or, you know, firing pins removed or whatever?
Yeah, they are all, we don't collect, as a rule, we don't collect deactivated firearms. I struggle to think of, I always struggle to think of a good analogy with other museum objects, you know, but, you know, you wouldn't, to use my teapot example from earlier, you wouldn't knock the spout off a teapot so that no one scalded themselves if they put hot water in it.
Yes.
That and that's a little specious, but it's not a million miles away from how, because we have all of the security provisions that we do, that's not too far away from the truth in terms of, we do not want to cut the bolt in half, slot the barrel, weld metal into the... A modern deactivated firearm in the UK is a welded solid lump, and you lose a tremendous amount of sort of evidential value in terms of how it works. Interpretative value in the same way, you know, you won't ever be able to show someone how the thing loads, what the technical advantages, pros and cons are of that design, and various minor details that are perhaps only of interest to those of us that study the field.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, you lose all of those if you deactivate. And so, often it's funny, in our stores here, when we do get researchers from places like the States, and they'll come and stand in awe surrounded by all of these guns and go, why has this UK facility got all of these firearms? And I say, well, you're thinking of it back to front. The restrictive regime in terms of legislation is exactly why a handful of UK museums have very good collections of firearms, because they are by and large not in civilian hands. They are by and large in the hands of the authorities. And these collections, the Tower of London collection and the Patent Room collection that came together in 2005, are government collections in origin. So it stands to reason that we would have all of the cool stuff, because that's the view that the government has traditionally taken in English and Scots law.
Yeah. Now, one of the things I find intriguing with some of your videos is that you're not just talking about, you know, here's an interesting gun and this is the history and this is what we know about it, but you also go over, crossover, if you like, into the world of fiction and movies and even games. And you were recently reviewing a new World War II war game, and you were sort of assessing the weapons that were being fired, and you also assessed the weapons in Old West games and zombie killing games and the like. How's the connection there? Are you, in your spare time, you're a gamer as well?
Yes, although I think that personal connection is also a general connection. And there's a thread running through this conversation that often does come up, which is that in particular countries where there is not a gun culture, and I don't put any negative or positive spin on that phrase. Gun culture literally should mean a society, you know, how a society views guns. You know, is it a positive, permissive society for them? Is it restrictive, like this one? Mm-hmm. And in countries that don't have a gun culture, and we have one here, but it's relatively small and restricted, as discussed. In a society that doesn't have a sort of organic gun culture, there's a particular... All you have, your only way in to the subject, probably, are books, you know, non-fiction or fiction, and of course, movies, you know, the previous generation that looked after this stuff... Loved their cowboy movies, grew up watching those. Mm-hmm. Some of them got into the subject through those. War movies, of course, likewise. And the current generations, myself included, I'm getting on now, came up on video games as well. You know, so some more modern action movies and sci-fi, perhaps more so than previous generations. And then that whole world of video gaming. And so all those different media are the way you tend to encounter the subject. And I don't just mean firearms, but arms and armor in general. You know, you don't, unless you're into reenactment, mm-hmm. which is, you know, that's another way in, of course.
Yeah.
Unless you join the armed forces or the police, you don't come across, and obviously some of those don't have, like if you join the police, you don't encounter plate armor.
Yes.
No, well, yes. Not the traditional form anyway. And so you might find a way into part of the subject, but you won't be exposed to all of it. So we're one of the only places in the world, actually, where all three aspects, if you like, well, all two aspects, the weapons and the things that protect you from the weapons, are studied and displayed in one place, and not just as an art history thing. You know, the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York is amazing, and they have a wonderful collection of antique arms and armor, but they stop at about 1880. They're not interested post that, and they're not really interested so much in what we tend to call the use and effect.
Yeah.
And then the other aspect of that is that pop culture reflection of it, which, you know, some people might see that cynically as, oh, it's just a way to get the kids interested, get bums on seats, people through the door, and then you hit them with the real chin strokey historical stuff. Well, I don't see it like that, and neither do some of my colleagues here. So we started collecting, doing some contemporary collection, which we'd been doing for years with things like modern firearms and modern body armor, but we sort of pivoted to movie props, in particular the movies. And we opened a display in 2019, mm-hmm. I think. Time has lost all meaning at this point.
Yes. Some time back in the good old days, pre-COVID, yes.
the before times, as I've heard it described, which I think is from an old Star Trek episode. But anyway, so the culmination of that sort of four-year project was to open a permanent display here at Leeds of arms and armor from the movies. Mm-hmm. And it's had a great response. And it isn't just people going, oh, well, I didn't care about this stuff before, and now I still only care about the fictional stuff. It really does spark some interest across the different ways of getting into the subject and the different areas of interest, I think. Mm-hmm. And whether they like to admit it or not, the more serious scholarly types, of course, are interested in some version of popular culture. It's just traditionally we have hived them off separately, whereas I see it all as a continuity. In fact, in that display, we start you off with the Eglinton Tournament, which took place in the 1830s. And was one of the sort of first modern efforts at, you know, nostalgia, representing the medieval period, getting dressed up in armor, recreating realistic props. You know, that's almost the beginning. And of course, there's the world of theater and then the movies and the rest of it. So to us, it's a valid part of our subject. And I know people like the V&A see it as a valid part of art, and other museums have seen the light on that as well.
Mm-hmm. Now turning to those, how realistic in the movies are their depiction of weapons? I mean, the Western cowboys type thing, you could be forgiven for thinking that it was the Colt 45 or nothing, but in fact, it was anything but that, almost, wasn't it? I mean, the Colt 45 Peacemaker came on relatively late in the scene, didn't it?
It was relatively late. If you take the sort of long view of the 1850s onwards as the Old West, it certainly wasn't the first thing to hand. And it was, although affordable, it was relatively expensive compared to what else was around. And I think even I have been surprised by the work of others showing just what the variety was. You know, there were European, you know, Belgian Bulldog revolvers. There were imported British Adams revolvers. And the majority were those sort of, not so much the Adamses, or the Colts, but the relatively cheap, you know, what have perhaps been termed later on Saturday night specials, mm-hmm. which is actually a term of a somewhat questionable origin. But, you know, things that were cheap and affordable, because if you needed a concealable firearm, it was for self-defense. And you know, perhaps you were up to no good. Perhaps you were doing it legitimately. It depended. And it depended on your means. Just as you might have a cheaper horse and cart, you might have a cheaper firearm. Or if you could afford it, absolutely, you would want one of Colonel Colt's latest But then there are the conversions. So a lot of the more capable sidearms would have been cartridge conversions of the old Colt Navy, Colt Army. And then even when you get into the era of the classic single action army, 1873 onwards, there's the Schofield break open, various different, it's, I think of it as, because it is, certainly is today, a product, a market of products like any other. Mm. And there are certain ones float to the top and become sought after. And then there's a sort of preservation bias as well towards the nice shiny things, and the old not great things get thrown away as well. So if you do, you know, people who've done excavations in old West towns and things have found a preponderance of cheaper but perfectly capable, you know, Ivor Johnson revolvers, for example, one of the cheaper American makers, more so than the nice single action armies, which got kept, got passed down, entered the antiques trade.
Mm-hmm. And single action, again, for people don't know, single action is that way you pull the trigger and it cocks the pistol and fires, or is that double action? Which is which?
This is a real rabbit hole. And I only in the last year have I realized how much of a rabbit hole it actually is. So the received wisdom, and I mentioned that because it's the semi-official name of the gun, not to sort of throw in a curveball, but it's a good question. So originally it meant something different. Today it means what you're saying. And single action, think of the cowboy movies where they are having to cock the hammer every time they fire a shot.
Yeah.
That is what single action now means.
Yes.
double action, you can just pull the trigger and the hammer goes up on its own and then drops.
Yeah. Why is it such a rabbit hole then?
Well, firstly, because it's actually quite hard. Like that, the simple explanation is hopefully straightforward.
Yeah.
But in terms of the detail, it gets more complex. And then in period, if you read the period sources, that definition doesn't, or rather that delineation doesn't make any sense, because they had a different distinction. Double action meant you pull through on the trigger or you can cock it. And it still does mean that today, but today it's expanded to cover anything where you pull the trigger and it cocks it. Originally that was called self-cocking.
Right.
And so a self-cocking, I did warn you. Yeah. the self-cocking was also single action, because you were performing a single action by pulling the trigger. You were performing a single action by cocking the hammer. This is why it gets very complicated very quickly. But so that people know what people are talking about in a modern context, double action is anything where you can just pull the trigger to fire it.
Yeah.
Which has the and if people are wondering why on earth would you do the cowboy thing, that's an excellent question, and I know you didn't ask it, but it's because the double action, where you can just pull the trigger like on a semi-automatic pistol.
Yeah.
Yeah. Think a double action revolver and a semi-automatic pistol function the same as far as the user's concerned. Once you've cocked it, that is.
Yeah.
The semi-automatic. All you're doing is pull the trigger to fire it. So why on earth would you want single action? And it's because it came first, essentially. Mm-hmm. Sam Colt patented cocking it first as the way you did it. It was mechanically simpler. It was cheaper. And at least in the States, the early double action attempts got a reputation as being unreliable. And the ones that work, like the Adams revolver that I mentioned earlier, which is beautifully hand finished, were extremely expensive, because you needed guys working hundreds of man hours to finesse all the parts to fit together and actually function. Whereas the idea of the Colt was more so that an unskilled person could assemble one on a production line.
Right, gotcha.
Didn't quite work that way until later on, but that was the ambition, and certainly Colts were more available, cheaper. They were American made, damn it. And so they dominated the American market, and that's why the classic scenes of thumbing the hammer back or fanning the hammer with your hand, that's why those dominate the cowboy movies.
Did they really fan it back? as opposed to, no. I mean, I've seen it in the cowboy movies, and I'm old enough that when I was a kid, toy shops were full of toy guns, very, very realistic looking ones. And I mean, we'd all be out there playing, shooting each other, doing the fanning the thing. But did they actually do that? Or is that one of those myths that's grown up?
It's a myth. It's always hard to say definitively, no, something didn't happen. But we do know a bit about the origin of the sort of the golden age of the Old West, i.e. a couple of generations after the Old West had ended in the 40s. There was a sudden resurgence of interest because it was now old and mysterious and interesting and fun and violent and sexy and all of that. Yeah. And so we see, you know, a resurgence of written stuff. The real sort of beginning of proper cowboy movies that we know and love, and something that's not so well known, perhaps outside the States, shooting and collecting of those firearms. So the antiques market for those went through the roof. Reproductions started to be made. Colt themselves brought back that single action army, the 1873, the peacemaker, whatever you want to call it, brought that back into production for sheer demand. And a whole genre of sports shooting called cowboy action shooting began, which still exists today. And like any form of sport, it goes to the nth degree. People become tremendously competitive. They're after the speed advantage. So holsters change entirely. The guns don't change because there are strict rules about what you can have, but how you operate them, they're literally gaming the system to run these slow to operate things as fast as possible. So you'll see Winchester rifles shot as the lever comes up. So the guys are just blatting away as fast as a semi-automatic rifle. Absolutely incredible. But you wouldn't have done that in the day. They're downloading their ammunition so that the recoil isn't too severe so that they can run them faster, because all they're doing is punching holes in paper. And this is where fanning the trigger comes in. So competitive sort of action target shooting they come up with faster ways to shoot the revolvers that way. And then for the trick shooting side of it, which is not, well, I say it's not so much a sport, but it is done competitively. This is where your fast draw comes in. This is why the holsters change. So in the Old West, you had a little soft leather belt holster, almost like a purse. Well, some of them were. Some were more like holsters that we'd recognize today, funnily enough, like a pancake type thing that sits on your belt. And it's accessible enough. You get it out when you need it, sits on your belt when you don't need it. People were not getting into gunfights every 5 seconds in the Old West, strangely enough. But for rapid, fast draw shooting, which then bled back into the movies, you have that classic low slung, probably double holster for two pistols. You're clearing the leather as fast as you can and getting the hammer back as fast as you can. And what's the fastest way to do that? You fire from the hip and you use your left hand to slap the hammer. I don't think anyone had even thought of doing that in the 1880s.
Right.
And there'd be no need for it. There'd just be no need for wasting expensive ammunition, wearing out your gun, and generally making a scene of yourself by, spamming the gun in that way.
You're listening to the Weird Tales radio show with Charles Christian.
Yes, because, I mean, when you do read accounts of actual Old West gunfights, and as you say, there aren't that many of them, but, the Earp brothers at the OK Corral, they're really quite shambolic, aren't they? There's sort of lots of shooting, but not that much action in terms of hits or wounds and things. Whereas, of course, in the Western movies, we're used to bang, 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 and three people are dead on the floor.
Yeah. Old West gunfights were much like modern gunfights. Scrappy, violent, but, people would often survive because people would miss. And if they were struck, they might get to a doctor in time. That's the critical difference, is if you're shot today and you get to a hospital within an hour, you've got a very good chance of surviving a handgun gunfight. Less so in that period. But still, not many shots were fired. They weren't reloading probably at all. equally, they weren't doing the 18th century formal back-to-back or high noon across a square dueling either, for the most part. There are, you know, a handful of accounts of that going on. Generally, it was, you know, disagreement in a bar or something, although a lot of towns had prohibitions on firearms being brought, you know, into the town limits kind of thing. And it just wasn't that common.
Now, going on to one of the other myths, again, showing my childhood obsessions, anything to do with the Second World War, all the Germans are armed with Lugers. True or false?
In the Second World War, not all of them, because the Luger was being phased out. The production continued, I should stress, but the intention had been to phase it out. So from 1938, the P-38, which people may have come across from Second World War films, but they would have seen in things like The Man from U.N.C.L.E., because there were lots of them floating around, as there were Lugers and other things. But the P-38 was the much more modern, cheaper to make, more reliable, all-round better German sidearm. And in theory, you'd have put all the Lugers in storage or sold them off or whatever and gone straight over to that. But of course, there's a war on. So you keep using the Lugers you've got and you keep making them because factories are already tooled up to make them. And you have a lot of pistols to supply people with. You know, officers, machine gun crews carried them, vehicle drivers, signalers, you know, people who don't need a rifle as their primary weapon. There is a surprising number of those people to equip. And then, of course, you know, general staff, you name it, anyone that just needs a self-defense weapon on their hip needs a pistol. So militarily, they're not very significant in the broad scheme of things. But if it's the only weapon you've got, it's vital, and you need hundreds of thousands to millions of them, depending on who you are. So both, sorry, that's a very long-winded answer, but both is the answer. They used the Luger throughout the Second World War, but it was increasingly supplemented by the P-38, which was really the better pistol.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of the things that's intriguing, is that you tend to think, oh, it was revolvers, revolvers, and then in modern times, the automatic pistol, semi-automatic pistol came along. But in fact, the earliest semi-automatics were 1890s, weren't they? It's sort of...
Absolutely.
Even the Browning, I mean, that was 1912, or the classic one, isn't it? But I mean, they actually are quite old.
Round about 1902 is where the first sort of working John Browning designs for FN and for Colt start to appear, and you know, instantly become very successful. And the ones just before that you're alluding to, the first commercially viable one is the Burkhardt, designed by Hugo Burkhardt, and is this wonderful steampunk-looking contraption with a huge... It's actually a housing for the spring and the lock mechanism hangs over the back of your hand, so it looks completely unlike a modern pistol and wasn't amazing. But the basic mechanical side of that was redesigned by Georg Luger into the Luger, and the Luger emerges in 1900 as well, as in its initial form.
Yeah.
And alongside that, we've got, in 1896, the Mauser broom handle, the C96, appears and is the first truly successful self-loading pistol, I think it's fair to say. Something I wrote a little book on a few years ago. It's iconic, it's fascinating, and it's another one that straddles pop culture with things like Star Wars and some of the Westerns where they use it as a sort of futuristic weapon of the era, you know, sort of future shock culture clash, where Joe Kidd is the classic, where he pulls out a 10-shot broom handle with, you know, and the bullets will go through much more than the equivalent revolver kind of thing, which is how it was seen at the time. You know, you had everyone from British Army officers in South Africa to anarchists in Ireland, all wanted to get their hands on that because it was the latest thing. But then just 5 or so years later, it was no longer the latest thing. In fact, it was pretty old hat because technology is moving so quickly.
Yeah. Yeah, you mentioned that the the Mauser crops up as the model for the blaster, the handheld blaster that they use in Star Wars, and the stormtroopers, they use a variation of a Stirling machine gun or something, isn't it?
That's right, the Stirling submachine gun, yeah. In fact, we have one of the things we acquired, or two of the things we acquired, because we got a Rebel one as well, which was also based on the Stirling. We did acquire two original Empire Strikes Back blasters to go with our real Stirlings.
Yeah. Oh, that's priceless. What about you and the armories? What are your next ambitions? What are the next things you're looking out for or hoping to expand on?
Well, we're in a bit of a sort of consolidating phase at the moment for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
And I'm still in my post massive book phase of going back to cataloguing and inquiries and that kind of core work and managing things as well, attending meetings and all the stuff that we all have to do.
Yeah.
In office jobs. I mean, I like to say this isn't an office job, but it does involve some of that stuff. What I'm finishing up at the moment, though, is a bit of work on very early revolvers. So I had an article a few years ago on probably the second oldest revolver in the world. The first is over on the continent. Ours is within 5 or 10 years of that, and it's a flintlock revolver that's on display in our self-defense gallery. If people come and see us, you can go and see this amazing brass 2-pound lump, which I mean, I'm underselling it there because it absolutely prefigures Colt's single action that we were talking about earlier. You know, when you cock it, the cylinder revolves, and that's just astonishing for 1680 or thereabouts, which is what it's dated to. That's amazing. And so my current article that I'm just finishing up, I need to get out and about when I can and see the other two that exist in other collections. Is the next era of that. So it's another couple of generations on using the same basic design. And all of that is supporting another book that I co-authored the first chapter in, which is all about those early revolvers before, not only before Colt, but before Collier, which is another thing I'm throwing into the mix, sorry. But Collier also beat Colt to it in terms of a revolver that when you cock it, it turns the cylinder. So
right.
Colt didn't invent the revolver. He just perfected it.
Yeah. Bit like Henry Ford with the cars.
Absolutely. And especially if you're looking at the mass production angle, you know, they both championed industrial mass production in their respective fields.
What's the weirdest things you've got in your collection? I mean, again, there was a video you had recently of a special one-shot pistol to prevent you being attacked by garrotters. And it was basically a very small barrel on a metal thing round your neck and a pull tie. So if somebody grabbed you from the back, you could pull the trigger and it would shoot them. And
that's right.
I think you said one of them showed signs that it had actually been used, whether in anger or just for a demo.
I think that's... Or they, because we have three of them now. That's one of them, I would say. It's hard to know where to start. Collections like this tend to amass the weird stuff, either because of military trials, where, you know, it's sort of road not traveled, doesn't get adopted, but you end up with it anyway. You know, that's the whole premise of Ian's Forgotten Weapons website. Or because they're just of interest, and museum visitors or visitors to the old MOD collection would have thrilled to see, you know, some of the weird stuff. So you always end up with, in fact, there's a whole sort of sub-genre called Firearms Curiosa. Right. There's a book of that title, in fact. And it includes, you know, things like patents for a gun that you wear on a helmet on your head, so it sticks out of your forehead, just ridiculous stuff. that was never made, as far as I know. But the chap who wrote that book poses in the front pages of it. People may have seen this picture online with a breastplate covered in flip down pistol barrels that was built. So you literally had a barrage of shots you could fire from your breast. Just crazy. We don't have that, but we do have a good line in things like pen guns. In fact, we have a gold plated pen gun that belonged to Lord Mountbatten, that we purchased a few years ago, which is pretty amazing and has that historical connection as well. One of my favorite things, which are, I wrote it up in a sort of somewhat academic fashion as well, but there's a version on the firearm blog that you can Google up as well, is, I keep using the word steampunk for things. It's not strictly accurate if you know your, you know, fiction, but it's the back half is a Martini Henry rifle. The front half is a grenade launcher. So it's a Martini Henry grenade launcher. And it looks like something that some sort of Victorian space captain in some sort of might well be wielding. But it's not completely insane. It was designed, what we often find in the development of in the history of technology, be it firearms or anything else, is some absolute maniac comes up with the initial idea. Then someone's able to make it, but it's probably too expensive or too difficult to make, or too expensive to buy, too complicated, doesn't work very well. You've got to wait for other technologies to sort of come on stream to make it work. We see this countless times. And this is one of those. So it worked fine. You know, you could fire grenades from the shoulder and therefore aim where your grenade's going and send it out. You know, they came up with rod grenades where you stick a hand grenade on a rod, you fire it out of your rifle so you get the range, but you had to fire it with the butt on the ground so you didn't get accuracy. You couldn't fire it into a trench 200 yards away. Yeah. Whereas this thing, if you've ever seen a Vietnam War movie or Terminator 2 with the M79, it's like a giant shotgun. You break open, put a grenade cartridge in, and you can fire that wherever you like it with significant explosive effect, shall we say. Crops up in games as well. Well, this thing is an Edwardian M79 grenade launcher. Absolute genius. Could have been pretty revolutionary, but the technology wasn't quite there to make it safe and reliable, I dare say. There's a lot of conservatism going on at the time, of course. You know, still got bolt action rifles. We've only just adopted the machine gun, for God's sake. We can't possibly have this contraption. Mm-hmm. And the final bit of the story is this amazing kind of moustache twirling villain of a financier who appears on the name. It's called the Blanche Chevalier grenade launcher. And he was the funder, but he was an absolute fly by night, and he'd scammed a series of people, and he scammed this poor guy. And so he didn't have the funding to carry on with it anyway. Right. And it didn't go anywhere. And yet here we have. I walked into the sort of reserve store one day and saw this thing lying sort of unregarded on a bottom shelf and started into researching it. And it's absolutely fascinating. Completely irrelevant to military history as we know it, but in terms of technology and what it in theory enables people to do and what the thinking process is and what the social history of the people involved is, it's fascinating. And you can see that on display as well, because I made damn sure that was crowbarred in to the First World War display.
One final question. I'm keeping you a long time. What's the most valuable? I mean, we see all these things. The Nazi regime seemed to be quite keen on handing out gold and silver-plated pistols to various dignitaries. Some people go in for completely over the top, encrusted with diamonds and everything like that. But what's the most valuable guns in your collection? Presumably it's the rarities, is it?
Do you know, it's a little hard to say. It's not. It sounds trite, but it's not how we tend to think of the things. Probably it would be one of Henry VIII's guns.
Right.
You know, in a God forbid if the whole thing fell apart and we were forced somehow to sell something, because that's the only time you would ever be able to get a meaningful market value for these things.
Yeah.
I mean, that would be in, I don't know, tens of millions? I genuinely don't know what it's worth. It has an insurance value for indemnity purposes, but I don't know what the market value would be. And we have two of those as we're talking about firearms. And they're both breech loaders. You can find pictures of both on our collections website if you have a look. And they're both on display at the Tower of London in the White Tower. I'm not quite sure yet whether you can get back in there or not, I must admit. But all of the arms and armour at the Tower of London is still ours. Mm-hmm. And these are ahead of their time. They're not rifles. People look at them and go, oh, well, they're there must be rifles. Wasn't really necessary with a very well-made smooth bore for the sort of work they were used for, which was target shooting at relatively close range and shooting birds on the ground or off branches at relatively close range. So it was precise out to a short distance, if that makes sense.
That does, yes.
But having said that, they have full sets of sights, and you pull the sight back and it unlatches the breech. You flip the breech open. It's very much like the Snider rifle from, what, four centuries later. I can't count. Only it doesn't have, again, this is where technology is contingent on itself. So you can't load it with a modern centerfire cartridge because they hadn't been invented, but you could load it with a reloadable chamber. So you loaded it like a little mini musket with powder and bullet. You could potentially have a load of them on standby or even in a bandolier, in theory. Slot one in, close it up, make sure your lit match is lit. And then when you pull the trigger, the match goes into the pan and fires that cartridge. Flip it open, pull out the cartridge, load the next one. So Henry VIII would have been one of probably a handful of people around the world in the 1530s and 40s that had firearms technology of that nature. And they're also, they're in a bit of a state, unsurprisingly, that at that age, having knocked around unloved for a couple of hundred years before the tower started operating a bit like a museum. But they are, you know, they were beautifully carved wooden stocks, beautifully hand-filed barrels, lots of detail, iconography on there, gilding. One of them had a velvet cheek piece on it originally because we have the inventories down at the tower that list them. So we have various valuable and important things, but for me, it's probably those two. Mm-hmm. Call them handguns in the original sense of a portable firearm.
Right.
It's an arquebus, if you want to call it something technical.
One question I meant to ask you when we're talking about TV shows and movies. When the latest Romeo and Juliet movie came out Leonardo DiCaprio, in the gang fights, they were firing their pistols sideways over. And I've then seen it in lots of gangster movies, etc., that it becomes a fashion that you fire your pistol, if you like, the wrong way around. Am I right in thinking that's just bonkers and that you'd have very little control over them?
Well, this is, he's sort of disappeared from the public eye a bit, but I used to follow a scientist sort of slash science communicator called Ben Goldacre. And he had a t-shirt at one point that said, "I think you'll find it's more complicated than that." and that's almost become a motto for me, because what we often see in all technical fields, people will scoff one way or the other and say, "No, that absolutely never happened," or, "Oh yes, this was the way it was always done." And the truth's usually somewhere in between. There are some things that just outright didn't happen, or at the very least we have zero evidence for, like fanning the hammer on a revolver. Can't rule it out, but it probably didn't happen. Well, this one is the modern trend that was reflected in that film, because they were obviously mashing up Shakespeare with modern gang culture. So that was already a thing in the 90s, was that you would hold your pistol to one side. So that is absolutely unrelated to what I'm about to tell you, I should stress. So it's really more of a convergent evolution thing, if you like, than any kind of connection. It's not that it's always been done and it's carried right through to the streets of Compton or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's not that. But so the way the gangsters do it, absolutely pointless, counterproductive. Chances are you're going to miss, especially as they don't tend to even try and use the sights when they do that. Mm. It's a posturing thing. It's absolutely a display thing, a macho, look at me, I'm projecting power. You know, it's like throwing a punch in a sort of stylized way. So that's really what that is. I'm sure there's some sociology that could be done on that. there is an historical parallel, which is what I'm kind of skirting around, in cavalry use of pistols going back to the 17th century. Mm-hmm. And we have artistic depictions from the wars in Sweden in the 1630s, 30 Years' War period, and later in the cavalry units in around the Napoleonic period. So from that whole swathe of history, cavalry would cant their pistols to one side. And we don't entirely know why. We know in a modern context it's done for fashion reasons, as you rightly identified. Mm-hmm. There's probably an element of that here as well. But, you know, there's no way that a modern gangster saw an engraving from the 1630s and went, I'm going to fire my Glock like that. these are wheel lock and early flintlock pistols, and they're holding them to one side. So various theories. To cut to the chase, my preferred theory is that they are using them like they use a sword. When you hold a cavalry sword or saber, you cant the wrist to present the point. It's just a biomechanical advantage to turn the arm like that as you thrust. And I think they are mimicking that, or they are consciously doing that because they feel it works the same way. Because these things were fired at basically contact range.
Mm.
Yes, you weren't thrusting the point into the enemy, but you were throwing the bullet into him from a few feet.
Right.
Or even, you know, some historical sources say you should touch the muzzle of your pistol to your enemy when you pull the trigger to be sure of killing them. You only get one shot.
Yes.
Which seems odd, because why not use a sword? But obviously a 50 to 70 caliber pistol bullet crashing through your body does tend to do more damage than a narrow sword point does. So that, you know, that may have been the logic.
Yeah.
Fascinating sort of historical parallel. But yeah, if you see that now, it's purely a fashion thing.
Right. Oh, that's brilliant. Well, Jonathan, it's been an absolute delight talking to you. And thank you ever so much for your time. Good luck with the researches, and I will keep watching the videos.
Thank you, and thank you very much for having me on. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Once again, a big thank you to this week's guest, Jonathan Ferguson. You can find everything you need to know about the Royal Armouries at https://royalarmouries.org and on the YouTube Royal Armouries channel. We'll have the full links available online. Now it just remains for me to say, this is Charles Christian saying thank you so much for listening in. Please join me again next week for more weird tales in weird times. Until then, stay well, stay weird. Goodbye.
Black Shuck, the demon dog of East Anglia, is baying at the moon. Which means it's time for us to go. You've been listening to the Weird Tales radio show with Charles Christian. Your weekly fix of ghost stories, urban myths, witchcraft, folklore, and the paranormal. You can keep in touch with us online at www.urbanfantasist.com, by email to urbanfantasist@icloud.com, and on Twitter at @urbanfantasist. Join us again next week for another edition of the Weird Tales radio show. Goodbye.